This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 126th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is the psychology of complicity. I'm joined by Max H. Bazerman. He is the author of Complicit, How We Enable the Unethical and How to Stop. The publisher is Princeton University Press. Max is a Jesse Isidore Strauss Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Besides being the author of books like Blind Spots and Decision Leadership, Max also describes himself as, quote unquote, a gritty city kid from Pittsburgh. Welcome to the show, Max.
Thank you so much, Dan, for inviting me to join you.
Absolutely. So briefly, what's the book about?
So Complicit is about all of the scandals that the listeners have read about, have watched miniseries about, but my focus is not on the core wrongdoer. Rather, my focus is on the dozens or hundreds of people that always surround the core harmdoer that allow the individual or small group of individuals to create the harm that ensues. Basically, I want all of us to think about the role that we play in allowing others to create unfortunate actions that harm so many of us.
Okay, and you've actually written three books on ethics. Is the evolution and the new insights kind of moving to this focus now on the surrounding people? Is that what distinguishes it from the previous two books or are there additional insights?
Well, thanks for the great question. So I wrote a book called Blind Spots with Anton Brentzel, which focuses on the psychology of why good people engage in bad behavior, often without knowing that they're doing so. And that book is very descriptive, very much of a social psychological or cognitive psychological treatment of why so many of us engage in behaviors that we wouldn't engage in with great reflection. The second book, Better Not Perfect, was really moving more in a philosophical direction and providing prescriptive advice on how we can all become better from an ethical perspective. And then Complicit is certainly in the theme more in line with the book Better Not Perfect, but Complicit focuses on a very specific way in which we could be better, and that is we could be better by avoiding complicity in the future. Complicit was not even on my radar screen as we entered 2021, and then the insurrection happened at the U.S. Capitol, and I was prompted to think about all the people who were complicit in allowing a small group of people to build enough power to pursue a white supremacist anti-democratic agenda. And as I thought about this issue of all the complicitors, people who stood by and allowed this power base to build, I realized that it applied not just to the political events that we had seen develop culminating in the insurrection, but in fact, it applied to every scandal that we could look at that was dominating the press at the time. So I put complicit and better not perfect very much in the prescriptive camp, which is very different than the descriptive perspective that I provided with Ann Tenbrunsel in the book Blind Spots.
Okay, well, I find that evolution interesting because, several times in the book, the Trump administration, for instance, comes up. And in my own work as an expert studying the emotions, the personality, for instance, of presidential candidates for CNN and Fox and MSNBC, I always try to take a very neutral, objective kind of point of view. But I admit that the phenomenon of Trump caused me to decide that I had to be, take a little more proactive stances to the challenges that were out there for fear of what it meant for harm for society and for our body politics. So that evolution is definitely of interest to me. Now, in the book, you mentioned 7 different behavioral profiles. Seemed to me that's fairly foundational, so we should probably make sure we get around to that quickly in the interview.
Sure. So the book originally had a title called Profiles in Complicity and eventually was shortened to the title Complicit. But the book is built around different reasons why people end up being complicit. And I focus on the most extreme versions, which I view as the intentional forms of complicity, where some harm doers have true partners. So while Purdue Pharmaceuticals kind of distributed opioids and harmed the public in order to create profit, McKinsey was right by their side, also earning profit by advising Purdue on how to mismarket opioids to create greater profit. And then there are people who are collaborators, people who don't necessarily agree with the core harm doers, the core harm doers' basic intentions, but they work with them to get other things they want in return. So Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham may not be white supremacists or be against democracy, but they were willing to put up with Trump's actions in that direction in order to get what they wanted in return as part of the deal. Or if we look at Volkswagen's Dieselgate, where they polluted the air in a truly fraudulent and harmful manner, the unions in the Lower Saxony government allowed Volkswagen to do this because they wanted to maintain the economic environment and the job security that they valued. So those are two forms of ways in which people are complicit, typically where they're aware of what they're doing, true partners and collaborators. But the core of the book is more about the rest of us, those of us who are complicit without necessarily being aware that we're allowing the harm to occur. So in the book, I talk about people who benefit from privilege and therefore allow the harm to occur. So I'm struck in academia by the large number of faculty members who basically don't notice the unethical aspects of legacy admissions policies in many of our top universities, where many universities give favorable treatment to the children of alumni, to the children of faculty, to the children of donors. And when we're actually part of the group that's benefiting, we often simply don't notice the harm that's being created. Another way in which we engage in ordinary complicity is when we sort of fall victim to being lured in by false prophets. Many of your listeners will remember Jim Jones in the People's Temple, a cult leader who got his members, over 900 of them, to drink the Kool-Aid, even though it wasn't Kool-Aid, it was actually Flavor-Aid. He was a false prophet who led his cult followers to their deaths. Unfortunately, we have people who set themselves up as false prophets in corporate context. So I think of people like Elizabeth Holmes, who demanded the reduction of deliberation by employees. There was an expectation of having true faith in the product in Elizabeth Holmes herself. We often
sure.
hear,
and if I could jump in there, because when you're mentioning false prophets, I have to think about Sam Bankman-Fried, who's all over the news at the moment, and kind of draped the whole thing in the concept of effective altruism. I'm sure you've got a take on him.
Sure. So I have multiple views on your question, but absolutely, I think Sam Bankman-Fried falls into this category. What false prophets have in common is that they tell us that the world has changed, the old rules don't apply, and you simply need to put faith in something you don't understand. And I think that when leaders are telling us to sort of deliberate less, to think less, and to trust more, that's when we need to be suspicious and be careful that we're not being lulled in by a false prophet. But absolutely, I put sort of Sam Bankman-Fried and the Bernie Madoff, Elizabeth Holmes category of setting themselves up as false prophets and claiming that they have some magic that the rest of us can't quite understand. So in addition to benefiting from privilege and believing in false prophets, I also talk about the ordinary complicity that results when we defer to authority and loyalty. And we could think about sort of some of the sexual assaulters and rapists of our times, like Harvey Weinstein or Jeffrey Epstein, who had people around them who knew what was going on and allowed their terrible behavior to occur. And basically a deference to authority was occurring. But we can also think about situations where people are loyal to the institution. So how did so many people allow the rapes to occur at Penn State, at Michigan State, and under the auspices of the Catholic Church? And I think that the answer is that our loyalty to the institution blinds us to the magnitude of the harm that's being created at ways that are a little bit shocking. My colleague Josh Green wrote a terrific book called Moral Tribes, where he highlights that sort of the more and more we're loyal to some subgroup, the more we may be allowing harm to occur to people who aren't part of that group.
Sure. So in terms of the psychology of complicity, so you mentioned in the book the role of fear, of course, that we're afraid if we're a whistleblower, we may lose our job, our authority, our career. I'm hearing about, deference to authority and submissiveness, loyalty that gets exploited in unfortunate ways. Any place else you want to go in terms of talking about the psychology and the particular emotions that might be involved? It sounds like greed would be involved in some instances, certainly.
Sure. So we can think of lots of reasons why people go along. I'm most interested in situations where people go along and allow bad events to occur without even their own awareness. Generally, when people are greedy, they're aware that they're doing something for their own self-benefit. But so often we have people who aren't greedy, who are perfectly nice people, who end up being complicit. And chapter 7 of my book highlights another profile in complicity, focusing on trust. And it focuses on my own personal experience when I was about 80-85% done drafting this book, I got an email from this terrific group of social scientists who put out this blog called datacolada.org that does a good job of giving us information on problems in the social sciences, including ethical problems. And unfortunately, the email I received in the summer of 2021 was informing me that I was the fifth author of a 5-author paper published in 2012 that had fraudulent data in it. And as I read this very upsetting email, I became very convinced that the data collada people were providing me with very good evidence that, in fact, I had published a fraudulent paper. Now, I had not committed fraud. I did not know that my data wasn't real. But how did I end up in this situation? And my answer is a kind of another piece of psychology. I trusted others to do parts of the project, and I didn't do a good enough job of providing appropriate oversight. So I even saw problems with the data, and I asked questions. But when I got answers that would make me plausibly comfortable, I basically went with the comfort rather than digging in harder to learn more. So I think that trust is another psychological basis of why we allow harm to develop and unethical actions to develop. Sort of another thing that we do from a psychological perspective is that we create, we accept unethical systems. For example, in the United States, we have something called independent auditing, which I've argued for many, many years is not very independent at all, because companies basically hire the auditor that's going to look over their books. They rehire the auditor. The auditors often sell other services like consulting services. And auditors,
yeah, it's a manifest conflict of interest. Absolutely.
Exactly. And we have lots of conflicts of interest in society. And too often we sort of psychologically accept, but that's the way it's done. And I think that that's another unfortunate aspect. So the seven profiles in the book are true partners, collaborators, benefiting from privilege, false prophet, authority and loyalty, trust in relationships, and accepting unethical systems. So that gives you kind of an overview. But what I find intriguing is that when I ask executives why a particular scandal occurred, they often give me a simple answer. And the simple answer focuses on the unethical actions of Elizabeth Holmes. And I don't hear much about the incompetent actions of the board of directors, the acceptance of Elizabeth Holmes as a false prophet, Walgreens failing to do due diligence before they put the Theranos technology into their stores. So our tendency to look for single cause explanations for very complicated events has the byproduct of taking complicitors off of the hook and focusing the blame solely on the core harm doer. And again, I don't mean to take them off the hook. I simply want to highlight that the harm doers of the future are less likely to be able to get away with this, with creating massive harm, if the rest of us could avoid complicity in the future.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, no, it's a tremendously important book. I'm even thinking about the current scandal involving the EU Parliament, for instance, where they're refusing even now to have an ethics panel that would oversee the financial goings-on of members of the Parliament. It's just amazing. I wanted to go to that off-the-hook thing a bit because, you know, many years ago I read a wonderful book written by a Columbia University professor called The Rich and the Super Rich. It's published way back in 1968. You may or may not know about the book, but it's a powerful book, and it talks about at one point just catalogs all the times in which companies are unfortunately serial offenders. And in the case of Purdue Pharma, as you mentioned, in opioids, I mean, it's not simply that there's, you know, ill-begotten gains. There are masses of people who are dying as a result of these activities. Are we going to, and I know you're a business professor, so this must be very interesting, but I mean, are we going to really cause white-collar criminals to be behind bars? I mean, a mere fine doesn't seem to stop them. I'm not sure what it's going to take.
Well, so we are seeing some of the core harm doers end up being behind bars. So Bernie Madoff is there. Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani are headed to jail.
But the Sacklers are not. For instance, the McKinsey partners, the best I know, are not.
Yeah. So I certainly would like to hold people more accountable. I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a judge, so I don't want to tell you the people belong in jail when I can't tell you what criminal offense they've committed.
Certainly.
So my focus is really on righting the organization and righting the behavior and keeping the bad events from occurring rather than punishing the behaviors that have already occurred. That doesn't mean I'm against what you're suggesting, Dan. I want to hold people more accountable. But I do defer to people with legal knowledge before recommending that people belong in jail.
Oh, no, I completely agree with that. I just can't help, as I read your book, which is a wonderful book, to be outraged by the scope and the degree of harm caused by many of the instances that you raise. That's all.
I'm outraged by what I read and hear. And you mentioned Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX. And if the newspapers have the account right, what happened is truly amazing. And once again, we're going to find that Sam Bankman-Fried was not acting alone, but there were a set of executives around him. He had parents who were professors at Stanford Law School. He had celebrities endorsing cryptocurrencies that they didn't remotely understand. We had venture capitalists standing by, sort of bolstering Sam Bankman-Fried and declaring him a new prophet. So we have all the ingredients that I described in my book playing out on this FTX story on cryptocurrency that we're going to be that we'll get to see play out over the upcoming months.
Sure. So that attention to changing the culture, I want to make sure we don't run out of time here before we get around to proposed solutions, which is where you go to ultimately in the book, of course. Do you want to talk a bit more about that and how these steps to improve the culture of a company or how we vet individuals and understand them and our own role in this? What are those solutions you're proposing?
Sure. To start with, we should never accept that's the way it's done. The fact that that's the way it's done sure. is not reason why it should exist that way in the future. I think that we can help get people to think about the creation of harm in a more complex way, so that they understand the psychology of complicity rather than just the core harm doer. I think that we need to get people to think about the fact that when they allow bad to occur, they may be as culpable as when they are committing an evil action themselves. But there's things that our leaders can do in terms of encouraging people to speak up. So one of my consulting clients, a well-known organization that won't let me name them in this story, has a kind of a one-hour video that's shown to employees that consists of four different senior vice presidents all telling stories about the time that they went above their boss's head because their boss was doing the wrong thing and violating the ethics of the organization. And by creating this video, the organization is saying, we value a certain set of ethics, and simply deferring to authority is not reason for you to allow bad behavior to occur in the future. So what the top of the organization tells us can be absolutely critical. Another kind of pattern that we see in terms of the cultural environment is that across lots of different stories that break, whether it's Theranos or some of the data fraud stories that we've seen in academia, we see people coming out frequently about the evidence that they know after they find a partner, another peer who has seen similar behavior and is willing to speak out with them. So Tyler Schultz, who got a lot of press for coming out and speaking out against Theranos, against the wishes of his grandfather, George Shultz, does so after he connects to Erika Chung up here at Theranos, who's observing the same bad behavior. So often when we have the sort of power to know that we're not alone, but other people see the problem, it empowers us to move forward in more helpful ways.
Good, good. All good stuff. A really important book. I urge listeners to check it out. And I want to thank you, Max, for your time and for being my guest here on Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. This has been episode 126, The Psychology of Complicity. My guest, Max H. Bazerman, is the author of Complicit, How We Enable the Unethical and How to Stop. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an epigram. In this case, I'm drawing on one from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "You have just dined, and however scrupulously the slaughterhouse is concealed in the graceful distance of miles, there is complicity." Until next time, take care and be well.